Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. In his life as a poet, critic, speaker, professor, and world traveler, Robert Lima has met numerous notable people, from Salvador Dali to Robert Frost to Mario Vargas Llosa to Mother Teresa. The encounters are chronicled in his new book, Some People, which features anecdotes about more than 40 persons of interest. Robert Lima is a professor emeritus of Spanish and comparative literatures, as well as fellow emeritus of Penn State's Institute for the Arts and Humanistic Studies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're the author of 27 books, but none like this one. What was the impetus for writing a book about the interesting people you've met in the last 50-plus years?
This all began in Fort Dix, New Jersey, when I was doing my basic training there. And in our barracks, we didn't have much of a social life, but I found two other poets, Alan Plants and Don Katzman. And together, when the lights were out, we'd gather in a corner with flashlights and read poetry to each other. And when basic was over and our time in active duty was done, we went back to New York. We were all three New Yorkers. And Alan had connections in the village, in Greenwich Village. So he introduced the two of us into the poetry scene there. And there I met people like David Ignatow, Denise Levertov, Robert Bly, and numerous other people that I mentioned in the introduction to the book.
Your first introduction to New York City was as a 9-year-old Cuban immigrant.
That's right. I arrived from Havana to Puerto Rico with my aunt for about 8 months, and then my father, after he got settled in New York, called for us. So we traveled by train to Newark, and my father met us there, and we drove through the Lincoln Tunnel. But just before entering the tunnel, I was awed by the skyline of Manhattan. Even in those days, it was tremendous. It's what O. Henry called Baghdad on the Hudson.
You said this was the place that nurtured me and opened my eyes to the American experience. And that reminded me of a 2003 book by Daniel Kaye titled All Poets Welcome, The Lower East Side Poetry Scene in the 1960s. When you and your two friends became part of this poetry scene in the 1960s, was everyone welcome?
Yes, very much so, except when we started at the Cafe Chino, there was already a coterie of poets there, older by a few years than we were, and somewhat better established. Most of them had published at least one book. And we were not exactly allowed in. But eventually we managed on an off night or something to do some readings.
You said token opportunities on stage.
Exactly. And then eventually we found our way to the East Village, and there several people established a coffee house. And that coffee house was the first of the places where those of us who weren't part of that in crowd were able to really read. Then from there, we went to another coffee house, which is Le Deux Mégots. Unfortunately, they misspelled Mégots, and they put it, came out as two cockroaches instead of two cigarettes, the name of the famed poetry cafe in Paris. So we ended up at the Deux Mégots, and eventually I co-edited an anthology of the poetry there. And we had an open mic, as it were.
Just how important is it for poets to have that opportunity for public expression?
To me, it was very important. I was just starting out, and I didn't really have any connections. A couple of publishers would drop in, publishers of small presses and things like that. But I think just the opportunity to stand up and read before your peers, and that was wonderful, and it kept me going, kept me writing. Had that not been available to me, I don't know that I would have continued.
Your book begins with encounters in New York City, but it goes on to tell anecdotes, interesting stories about 46 different artists, and includes many artists who are of Hispanic descent. Tell us a little bit about your career, which has been to promote Spanish literature to an English-speaking world.
Yes, thank you for that. I was able to, when I was here in the department, head the lecture series for many years. So I took the opportunity to invite well-known people, critics, and creative writers to come to Penn State. And so in that context, I was able to further the local interest in things Hispanic, which, as you said, was one of my main goals. We had Vargas Llosa, as you well know, because you interviewed him here. And before that, we had many other prominent Spanish and Latin Americans. Borges, of course, was one of the principal people that I managed to bring. He came here twice in 1968 after he had just gotten married, and then again in 1983, 3 years before he died.
Your book also includes letters, personal correspondence between you and a number of artists. What I'm struck by when I read those letters is just what can be learned from reading a personal letter. And they struck me as so old-fashioned, so courteous and formal compared to the way we communicate with one another today.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Especially people, good friends like Paul West, who taught here for many years, wrote me wonderful letters, which I've included in there. Willis Barnstone and many other people that over the years I've dealt with. Now, none of my correspondence is in there, but correspondence from them to me. And so, as you say, it's a very personalized thing. But it is old-fashioned because, as you see, a lot of them are handwritten or typewritten.
And with a typewriter.
With a typewriter, good old-fashioned typewriters. And so they do communicate a certain kind of a more personal effort on their part. You know, they sat down and either wrote by hand or typed these letters. And so they're much more meaningful to me than something like an email, you know, that we get today.
Before we talk about some of the Hispanic writers and artists that you highlight in your book, there are a number of local artists. So there's Harold Altman, the painter and lithographer. There's Rob Fisher, the sculptor. Paul West, whom you mentioned just a moment ago, who was on the faculty here at Penn State and is well known for all kinds of writing, short stories and novels and more. Tell us a little bit about the local connections that you made, because it occurs to me that you sort of tried to create in central Pennsylvania the scene that was happening in New York City. So many opportunities for people to express their art in public.
Guilty as charged. But I started at the Beaver campus, and there, that's how I met Harold Altman, because I created an art project there, and we had two exhibits. And without knowing him, I wrote to Harold, and I asked him to participate. And not only did he send some of his things, but he also got a couple of the other artists here at Penn State to send material down to Beaver. So we had two very successful events down there. When I came up here, I, of course, met him and so on, and I own several of his pieces. As to Rob Fisher, I was preparing a surrealism event to celebrate the 50th anniversary of surrealism. And someone told me, you know, there's a fellow named Rob Fisher who's creating something called the Membrane Project. You ought to talk to him. So I went over to Waring Hall, and he had set up this incredible, fantastical-looking medium in which you walked in, and the walls had inside, the walls were screens projecting things, and the floor was very wobbly.
Those things were insects.
Yes. So I said, I met him and I told him about the event that I was preparing, and he got excited. And of course, I got excited to see this. So Rob ended up putting this installation in the Hub Ballroom, as it was in those days, in order for people to walk into the final event, which was the great surrealist banquet. They had to go through this membrane. Now, prior to that, they had been at the Nittany Lion Inn at a cocktail party. And we all walked, and this was in November, but it was still nice, and we walked all the way to the Hub, struggling to walk straight lines. And then they got in there, and they got onto this wobbly floor, and it was wonderful. Everybody fell over, and the insects were biting away and very noisily. And then we settled in for dinner.
And, of course, this isn't what most people know Rob Fisher for. His sculptures are in airports and in museums and in lobbies everywhere, yes. Yeah.
So, but this was the beginning of our connection.
One of the things that is clear to me is that you extend yourself to people. When you admire someone's work, you make these encounters happen.
I try to do that because I have an enthusiasm for them. Not only do I do that, but I also try, as you said earlier, to make that available or known to other people, either locally or elsewhere. And so many of these people are people that normally would not be very approachable. So I was fortunate, you know, that I was able to get close to them and talk to them. And Dalí was a case in point, you know.
Quite an interesting story. You're meeting him.
In New York, a couple of us went because I had heard that he was arriving there for an exhibit. And so I called him at the hotel and identified myself. I had written about him in my book on Lorca. And so
Garcia Lorca.
On Garcia Lorca, right. So he kind of knew a little bit about that. And then he said, well, I'll meet you at the gallery, at the Knoedler Gallery.
In New York City.
In New York City. So I went over there and I told them he was coming. They got all excited because they didn't know he was in town. They were setting up his exhibit. And when he arrived, of course, he came in with his fur coat and his gold-headed cane.
And his mustache.
His wonderful mustache. And I pursued him in the exhibit, trying to tell him about the surrealism event and that I would like him to be the star of the show. He totally ignored me. And finally, I said, I don't want to bother you anymore, Señor Dalí. And he said, turned around, spun with his cane in my face and said, bother me, bother me. So I continued to bother him. Got nowhere.
And, of course, you were interested in Salvador Dali because it had been rumored that he and Garcia Lorca were lovers.
Yes. Yeah, well, I think it was pretty well known at that time that they were. Dangerous times for people to be gay in Spain, especially. But I always liked Dali's daring art, his surrealistic vision. And, of course, Lorca was one of my very favorite. That was the first person I wrote about, the first book I did. So that connection was there, and it was very eminent for me to get in touch with him.
You actually asked Salvador Dali to sign a $25 or $30 poster that you picked up in the museum, and his reaction was priceless.
He just said to me, yes, but now it'll cost, and I forget how many dollars it was for his signature. I said, muchas gracias, Señor Dali, and I put the poster down and walked out, and that was the end of our encounter.
An interesting encounter that you recall in the book is one that happened when you were about 18 years old, a freshman in college in New York City, and you went to the West Side, West Village, where you knew, or you hoped, you would run into your poet of poets, Dylan Thomas. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Dylan Thomas used to come to New York with some frequency to do lectures and readings and things like that, and this I had heard was happening, and so I went down to his favorite pub, and because I was not able to drink, I could not really walk in there, so I kind of opened the door and looked in, and I saw him. He was a big, hulking man, bent over the bar, and just put his hands down on the bar and his head on his arms, and so I stared at him, I don't know how long. Eventually, the barman or barkeep, whatever, came over and asked what I wanted. And I just said, I just wanted to see Dylan Thomas. And he said, how old are you? And I told him the truth. And he kicked me out of there. So that was my only encounter with him. But then many years later, of course, he died shortly thereafter. Many years later, I had occasion to visit his grave in Wales and the house where he lived with his wife, Caitlin. And to actually sit at his desk and view the estuary of Larne, where he wrote so many of his poems.
You wrote a poem that was inspired by Dylan Thomas. In fact, you wrote poems about so many of the interesting people that you encountered in this book. But could you read that one for us?
I sure will. Be happy to. It's called Dylan's Walk. Above the estuary of Larne, seeing gentle as the water rolled ashore and out again to sea, he strode on his high walks with power of figure, mighty ken, and rolling voice that carried like the tide its own eternal gait. Above the estuary of Larne, poised within his flimsy wooden perch, eerie for the eagle in the man, he overlorded sea and land, and made them his through bardic voice.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The poet, translator, and literary critic Robert Lima is the author of 27 books. His latest is Some People, a book of anecdotes on writers, painters, musicians, critics, and other prominent people he met over the last 50-plus years. You mentioned that you met Dylan Thomas. You didn't meet Dylan Thomas. You saw Dylan Thomas in the flesh. He was actually one of four people that you did meet who died shortly after your meeting. The other was William Carlos William, Robert Frost, Randall Jarrell, and of course Dylan Thomas.
Incredible. When I thought back about those encounters and realized that I had seen them just shortly before they died, I felt somewhat guilty, obviously, because, my Lord, I better not meet any other poets because I might do them in, you know. But it was just a strange coincidence. I saw Robert Frost's last public reading in New York at Hunter College. Where I taught at the time. And Randall Jarrell was up at the Hunter College campus up in the Bronx at that time. Enjoyed his company a great deal. So those two immediately affected me because I said, my Lord, this is very close to me in terms of time and to see them shortly before their death. The William Carlos Williams was a different kind of story because I got to see him at home.
And he was very sick at the time.
Very sick. He had Parkinson's. And his wife was very, very caring of him. And I had brought a couple of books for him to sign, and I saw his condition, and I said, no, I'm not. I told his wife, I can't have him sign the books. And so she took them and insisted, gave them to him. And actually,
he insisted. He wanted to sign them.
He did. And as you see in the book, his signature from those books was amazing because it was just a scrawl that he made, but it's complete and a long name, William Carlos Williams, you know. And I was sitting there shivering because I was afraid that this poor man might have a worse stroke at that moment. But he managed to do it, and he enjoyed doing it, I think, because he smiled and he said a few words.
In fact, he gave you some advice.
He did.
As a poet.
Yes, he told me to write naturally, to not use any forms of earlier times. He said, you're an American, write as an American poet. And, of course, that's what made him what he was. And he became the Poet Laureate of the United States at one time and so on. So he was a poet who was celebrated for the American idiom that he wrote in.
Are poets and writers and artists, generally speaking, are they generous in that way to provide the kind of advice and encouragement that a William Carlos Williams provided to you?
That was unique in my experience in terms of a personal encounter of that type. But there was one other poet who influenced me a great deal, and was David Ignato, a New York poet. And he and I became friends, and I brought him to the Beaver campus to do a reading, and then I brought him here to Penn State also. He was kind of a follower of William Carlos Williams, so he kind of instigated me to do the same kind of writing in the American idiom.
You mentioned a moment ago Garcia Lorca. You write a story, a reminiscence of meeting his brother, Francisco. That's a really interesting encounter for a couple of reasons, in part because of what he shared with you when you met him in his apartment in New York City.
I had been working on my doctoral dissertation at NYU, and I knew that Francisco Garcia Lorca taught at Columbia. And I needed information for my biographical part of the book. So I managed to get a contact with my to-be publisher to introduce us. So I went over to his apartment on Riverside Drive, and he was very nice. He received me very amply and sat me down, and I talked to him. And then I said to him, you know, I'm looking for the manuscript of El Público. El Público.
The audience.
The audience, yeah. It's a play that was lost or thought to be lost because before Lorca died.
Before he was assassinated.
Yeah, thank you for saying it. He entrusted that manuscript to a friend in Granada, and somehow it never came to light after that. So I said to him, do you happen to know if the public exists? And he said, wait a moment. And he went inside and came back with a box and put it on my lap. And the box was tied with a ribbon, and I undid the ribbon, opened the box, and lo and behold,
there's the manuscript.
El Público was on my lap. And so I started looking through it, and kind of naively I said to him, do you mind if I take this and make a copy of it? That didn't go over very well, but he said, no, I'm sorry, because I'm planning to publish it. And I understood. And so, but at least I knew that it existed, even though I couldn't read it. So then I went and continued doing my doctoral work. eventually someone else published.
And the play was eventually performed.
Yeah, it was performed. It's been performed quite a few times. And it was published, but Francisco García Lorca never published
his copy.
That's right. The copy that he showed me never published.
Do you know if his copy included the missing chapters?
Yes, it was complete.
The missing acts, I should
say. Yeah, it was complete. Because I did find my way through it that way, and I saw that they went beyond those two that had already appeared. So it was kind of disappointing, but at the same time, it was an episode that I enjoyed retelling because it meant that I was there with his brother.
How well or how difficult is it to translate these great Spanish works to English? And I ask that because I think of a funny anecdote of translating Dove soap to French and then from French back, and what we get is pigeon on a stick.
Well, yeah, translating is something very, very difficult. If you're translating poetry, I think you need to be a poet. You need to be in the same kind of sensibility area that the original was done in. Prose is easier, although if you do something like García Márquez with that whole business of going back and forth in time, it becomes very difficult. But Gregory Rabassa, who I talk about in this book, did a marvelous job of doing that. The translations I've done Borges, some things, not a book of poetry, but some translations of Borges, and other Latin American writers, including many Latin American women. If I like the poem to begin with, then I feel more comfortable trying to translate it. If I don't really communicate with it in some form, then I don't do it. I just put it aside. And that's why I haven't done a collection of any one poet, because there's not everything there to be accepted by the translator. The translator has to be as one with the poet.
What you're saying makes me think of the fact that you weren't a big fan of Robert Frost, for example.
No, I wasn't.
And you left his presentation feeling the same way.
Yes, unfortunately. I understood the way he wrote and his technique and his subject matter, but it just never really spoke to me, you know. On the other hand, a T.S. Eliot, I just loved T.S. Eliot, even though he can be somewhat convoluted. Nonetheless, there was a certain richness in the language. And the same thing with Dylan Thomas. I just found both of them, even though they're so different, to be the kinds of writers that I could identify with and that I could find some satisfaction in reading.
One of my favorite stories in the whole book is about your relationship with Paul West.
Oh, yes.
There are two really interesting stories, which I guess I'll call body double. Paul West had a stroke in 2003, and so this master of words is having difficulty in communicating, but he still is.
He still is. He's still writing. After that serious thing, he has moments of lucidity in which he can then write. And, of course, his wife, Diane Ackerman, is at his side, and I suspect, I don't know for a fact, but I suspect that she takes dictation or he uses some kind of dictating machine. But yeah, Paul is very generous still. He still sends me his books. I have a collection of almost all his things, always beautifully autographed. And as you see in the book, a collection of his letters. So Paul and I, you know, started together here maybe a year or so apart. I think he was here a year or two before I came. And I got to know him very well, and I served on several doctoral committees that he chaired, and including Diane Ackerman's. And so we became close friends in that sense. And when I had this encounter of my double, what it was is that I supposedly was at Cornell delivering a lecture.
And he, of course, was teaching there at the time.
And he was teaching there, and he got mad that I didn't stop in to see him. As I explained to him, I'd never given a lecture at Cornell. I'd been considered for a deanship there one time, but never materialized. And I said to him, "I'm sorry, Paul, I was never there." He said, "Well, my friend was in the class, and she said you were brilliant." I said, "Well, thank God for that, you know." But I kept on denying. Well, the friend described me to a T, and, you know.
Even had a brochure about the lecture.
Yeah. And I said, "This is impossible." I said, "It must be my doppelganger, my spiritual double." And so we've left it at that. I think he's still suspicious of me, however.
And then there's the meeting in New York City. You think you're going to, or in London, rather. You think you're going to meet with him. And it's another Paul West, which is a very funny story.
That was so embarrassing because Paul had said, well, I'm going to be in London when you are. Give me a call. We get together for a drink and dinner. And I said, wonderful. But he didn't give me his address or his phone number. So I looked up in the telephone directory and I found it. So I called, and this gentleman answers the phone, and I said, I'd like to speak to Paul West. He says, I'm Paul West. I said, Paul, this is Bob Lima from Penn State, blah, blah, blah. Kind of there was a dead silence at the other end, and he eventually said, oh, yes, yes. He says, do come over. Okay, so I came over, and it turned out that when he opened the door, he was not Paul West. He was
not, not your
my
Paul West,
but... you know. And the man had brought in some groceries and
to prepare dinner for you.
Oh, it was embarrassing. I didn't have the nerve to stay. It's one of the worst things I've ever done. I walked out on the poor chap. But he was a writer also.
Right. So,
and, you know, and when I said Paul West, the writer, he says, yes, yes. And he had made a tour of the United States and he had invited some people, when you're in London, look me up. And so he thought I was one of those people.
Very funny story.
Oh, terrible.
Of all of the people that you encountered and reminisce about in your book, is there someone who stands out?
I would have to say, because of her renown, Mother Teresa. It was not a very long encounter, and it was in a situation where she was very ill, and we stood outside the convent window, which was barred, and yet she was there behind the grill, visible to us. And very generous.
When you say us, who was there to visit her?
We were there at a conference on mysticism, and a few of us were allowed to go. Actually, I asked permission, and some of the people joined in. So about five or six of us were allowed to go. And so we stood there outside the bar, and what I say in the book is that it was like in the old Spanish plays of the Golden Age, the lover would always stand outside the bar, and the beloved would be inside, untouchable, but there, visible. And it was like that. It was like being in front, in this case, of a living saint. And to me, that was an immeasurable, important event.
I'm going to go full circle here because, you know, so many of us here in the United States are talking about the normalizing of U.S.-Cuban relations. And I'm wondering, as a Cuban-born American, how you feel about that? What needs to happen on both sides for that to be successful? And do you think it will be?
I think it will happen in due course that we will have normal relations. I don't know that that's going to happen immediately with the establishing of the full diplomatic relations, but I think it will happen. And I know the Cuban people in Cuba are very up for it. The Miami Cubans, that's another story. They don't want it to happen. They don't want us to, in any case, to help provide funding of any kind, tourist dollars other than what they already get to Cuba. So there's a great divide between the Cubans resident in Miami. I say Miami. I'm talking about a broader scope of Cubans and the Cubans in Cuba, who are very open and welcoming to the idea because they think their lot will improve.
Well, on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Patty. Appreciate it.
That was Robert Lima, Professor Emeritus of Spanish and Comparative Literatures, as well as Fellow Emeritus of Penn State's Institute for the Arts and Humanistic Studies. His newest book is Some People, published by Orlando Press. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.